Welcome to, hopefully, the final revision lecture. Now, there is a remote possibility I can extend the class a little bit further, but to be brutally honest, I'd like people to actually have a shot at the final and see how they go, because that way we can finish you all up and pass you through. Because that would be nice, because I'm starting another class in another 2 or 3 weeks. However, if the world ends or 2012 comes early, we can probably extend the class by another week or three. I'm having trouble with my sensitivity as usual. Let us see what's going on here. Okay, how's that? Is that too hot? Can we deal with it?
That's fine.
Yeah, no problem.
It's easier to actually up the volume than it is to mess with ventrilo sensitivity, which is sad but true. Okay. Alright, what sort of things are you going to need to know for the final exam? Well, that is a $6 million question. We will be talking about a few things that you might need to know, and we will be talking through the sort of questions and stuff you're going to see, and the sort of diagram descriptions and stuff that you're going to see. Now, I did start reading through all of the course material last night and thought, yes, I'll sit down and make these wonderful notes, and I spent an hour going through chapter one and just went, meh, we'll just find things to talk about. So, here we are. I'm going to start first by covering the stuff that Pranav has asked. Nobody cares about connection termination. You basically get sent a fin packet, you acknowledge the fin packet, and your connection is dead. There is no question on that in the final, and if you would like to know about how fin works, may I recommend the Wikipedia article. As far as the three-way handshake is concerned, however, we will certainly talk about the three-way handshake and how that works. They don't actually cover how the connections are shut down in the curriculum.
I remember seeing it somewhere. Four things happen. Fin ascent, and then an ACK ascent, and so on. But if they don't cover it, no problem.
It's not in the final. They don't ask you how the connections are shut down. It's something you could look up. It's certainly probably in the that's right. You send a fin, you get an acknowledgement, then you're in time wait, and then you've actually got to send something else to actually shut it down. I remember something about that now. But we don't really cover that in great detail, so I wouldn't worry yourself too much about it.
Okay, that's good.
Okay, but the sequence numbers are something we do cover, and sometimes I think there is a question that relates basically to sequence numbers, so we'll talk about that. The problem with TCP... there used to be a problem with TCP where they used to start the sequence numbers from zero. So if you were clever, you could actually guess what the sequence numbers were, and you could actually spoof traffic. What happens now is that the sequence numbers start at a random interval, and they increment. So you pick a random number and start your sequence numbers from a particular number that's quite high. But what actually happens when you... So the first thing you do is you send a SYN, which starts your connection. And you set the sequence number to whatever it's going to be. And then you get an ACK back, which has a sequence number one higher than what you set. And then you send another synchronization.
This number which is higher, is this a plus one or a plus binary something?
No, it's plus one. Like, it's a counter. All the sequence number is a counter. So basically what you're trying to do with the sequence numbers is if you send a packet of 1,300 bytes, you increment the sequence number by 1,300 bytes. When you send 700 bytes, you increment it by 700. If you look at the difference between the sequence numbers of the two packets, you'll see that you've sent 2,000 bytes because one sequence number was 1,300 and one was 1,700.
So you don't increment by one. You increment by the size of the payload.
But the fact is that there is no payload in a SYN packet. That's my point. The SYN packet has no payload. It's just a SYN packet. There is no data in the initial exchange. When you initially open a three-way handshake, you send a packet with a SYN bit set and no payload. You then receive a packet with an ACK bit set, which is the connection number plus one. You then send another synchronization packet with the payload.
Okay, and that will be incremented by the size of the payload.
That is correct. So basically the three-way hand shake basically goes, "Oi, I'm talking to you." And the person goes, "What? Talking to me? Yeah, you." And then you start sending data. So it's a three-way thing. So you actually, and the reason it's a three-way thing is so you can sequence the sequence numbers on both ends of the connection. Because what you've got to understand is that there are sequence numbers in both directions. If you're sending data from a host to another host, there is sequence numbers that increment for that sending. And if you receive data from another host, even if it's on the same connection, there's another set of sequence numbers that run in the opposite direction.
Okay, and this is, of course, true for whether this is a half duplex or a full duplex connection.
Well, by definition, TCP is full duplex. You have to be able to receive acknowledgements, therefore the connection is by definition full duplex. Even if you are not receiving anything over a TCP stream, you still need to receive the acknowledgements for the packets that you're sending.
Okay.
And I think that's covered in Chapter 2 or 3. They talk about the sequence numbers and what they actually count up. It is theoretically possible to use Smart Sniff to look at the sequence numbers on the first three or four packets of a connection, if there's something you really want to see. The problem is they do start with quite big numbers, which is a pain.
Yeah, that's okay. I have read 2 and 3, but yeah, I was confused about this plus 1, and somewhere they said incremented by the amount of the payload, so I had got confused there.
Yeah, but as far as I know, there is no payload.
Two, yeah.
No. But, well, no. You see, with the SYN and the ACK and the SYN packets, there is no payload, so it is plus 1. So you send a sequence number of, say, 274... and you've got no payload, so the next sequence number that comes that you see on the return packet will be 275. The sequence number has to increment by something. It can't stay the same, otherwise it wouldn't be a sequence number, which is why they do it this way.
No, but I thought they always incremented by one. I didn't realize that once your three-way handshake was done, that payload starts, then it starts incrementing by the size of the payload.
No, it's definitely incremented by the size of the payload, and the reason they do that is because if you're actually running selective acknowledgement, which is where, rather than acknowledging every packet, you're only acknowledging certain packets, you can actually use the sequence numbers to figure out which packets you've received and which packets you haven't, so that you can make intelligent decisions on the transmit window, if you're using window scaling. And if you actually look on the net about optimizing your TCP performance and you're Googling up like TCP doctor or whatever, they will have all of this black magic stuff on things you tweak in the registry to change the window size and the selective acknowledgement and the window scaling, which in my experience on my machines doesn't seem to do much. But people will try to twist every knob and turn every dial. Okay, so we all... I don't think they ask you much on sequence numbers in the test, luckily, anyway, but I think it's probably worth clarifying the concept anyway. Are we right to go on about TTLs, which is the next one I've got here? Okie dokie.
Sure.
So, if you look at a packet, generally your TTL starts at a high number. Whether, depending on what you're using, if it's Windows 95, it will be 32. If it's anything above that, it'll be 64. Sometimes it will be 128. Some odd machines start at 255. For every router the packet passes through, you decrement your time to live packet by one. So when it goes through your integrated services router, and you start at 64, you will then drop your TTL to 63. Once you go to the next router upstream, your TTL will drop to 62. The next one above that, 61. Above that, 60. So, and this is what is supposed to happen. It doesn't always happen, but it happens most of the time these days. So the TTL will be decremented by one for every router you pass through. This is useful because Traceroute actually sets the TTL to a packet to one. It then sends it out through the first router, which decrements the TTL and returns an ICMP time exceeded message from a specific IP address. This is how Traceroute finds out the first hop. It then sets the TTL to 2 and sends the packet out, and the second router along the path sends back a time exceeded method. So it actually sends it to an unused UDP port, and then it watches for the time exceeded messages to come back as the TTLs are incremented to show you the hops along the path.
Okay, that clarifies that.
So no packet theoretically could exceed, well, on a from a Windows machine, 64 hops to get to any destination anywhere without sort of expiring.
That is correct. And if that were the case, you would actually have to hack the registry. I'm just going to see what it is under XP here. Ping, www.qcat.org. Okay.
I think it's 32.
No, mine says TTL equals 64. This is under XP. It says, reply from 192.168.100.7, bytes equals 32, TTL equals 64. Which means it didn't pass through a router to get there. So, the point of the TTL is to make sure you don't get a routing loop. If packets go round and round and round, which they can if you've got a misconfigured RIP setup, you can then find that the TTL will get decremented, and then once the TTL drops below 1, you get a time exceeded message, and you know that there's a problem, so you chuck the packets away. Okay.
Got it.
ARP and proxy ARP. We don't really cover proxy ARP here. It's mentioned in the notes, but I've never seen it referred to in the test. But we will talk about what it is and why you'd need it while we talk about ARP. ARP is the address resolution protocol. And it is the protocol that is required to map. It maps IP addresses to hardware addresses. So, if you guys crack open a command prompt, we'll just do this practically here, and run ARP space minus A. So, for example, I'm seeing things like here that say 192.168.100.206.
On the MAC address.
No, you don't see the subnet mask.
No, I don't.
Let me show you.
IPs in the MACs. But I see weird ones like 192.168.1.800. Not valid as far as I know.
No, that's interesting. I wonder why they're showing up.
And it says it's dynamic. My DHCP pool is from 1.20 to 1. What did I set it to? 100, I think.
Yep, internet address,
that's what I'm getting.
Physical
that's the
address, and the type. Yep, the internet address is just the IP address that the ARP entry refers to. The physical address is the hardware address of the MAC address, and the type is either static or dynamic. Okay. So can anybody tell me what should there generally be? What entries should generally be in your ARP table if you are talking to the internet? In any capacity, if you're actually talking to the internet, what one is probably likely to be in there?
Your default gateway.
That is 100% correct.
As well, I don't know what the other stuff
your
is.
Own machine. Yeah, I don't know. I have some weird stuff too. I have 1.500, 1.600, and 1.800 that all have MAC addresses beside them, and all say dynamic. So I have no idea what those are. Maybe it's a Windows 7 funniness, and they're not even IPv6 worth things that I don't really understand.
Do you have multiple adapters? That could be one thing.
I have a VPN PPPoE, like a PPP adapter thingy, but it's not on at the moment. And it actually maps to a routable IP on the internet.
So, well, what you'll tend to find, and you can try this command on anything, you can try it on a Linux box, a Mac box, or a Windows box. I'm not sure why you're getting 600s, 700s, and 800s. We'd have to Google that up and find out why that's happening. But essentially, what you're dealing with is you are seeing these are maps from IP addresses to hardware addresses. So, this then raises the question, why is the ARP entry for your default gateway in your ARP table?
Probably because... Why is the ARP entry?
I promise you it's not a trick question.
No, it has to be something basic.
You know that. I always find the most basic things to wind you guys up. Just, you guys think it's all complicated, and it's not.
Well, hey, they're on the same network, so they only need MAC addresses.
Yes.
But I think it's too...
That's right. No, before you dig yourself into a hole, you're correct. On Ethernet, you talk to a MAC address. You do not talk to an IP address. You must have the MAC address to be able to talk to another station on Ethernet. The IP address is important, but the Ethernet packet is addressed to the MAC address.
Wow.
Yeah, you're right. You don't think of it in those terms. You think of sort of the destination being an IP, but... You're correct.
Well, this is why I mention it, because when you actually look at how Ethernet cards work, and we don't really in this course, but an Ethernet card listens for, regardless of whether it is plugged into a switch or not, it listens for packets that are destined to its MAC address, the broadcast address, and optionally a certain number of multicast addresses that you can program into the card to look for by software. And apparently it's some funny calculation where they take the intermediate result before calculating cyclic redundancy checksum, and there's a hash filter that figures which ones it's actually listening on, and it's all devilishly complicated, but it works. So if you think about it, if your machines are actually connected together by a hub, which they rarely ever are, you are going to see all of the packets turn up on your card because you're on a hub, or if you have a port on the smart switch in mirrored mode. So basically what you end up with is the card has to listen on a certain subset of addresses. When you actually run a network sniffer, you actually put your Ethernet card into what we call promiscuous mode, which means that it listens to all packets on the wire.
Got that.
Okie dokie. Now, what is proxy ARP and why should you care? Okay, picture an ISP that is running dial-up modems, just because it's the easiest, example to give. Okay, so you are loser user and you have a dial-up modem and you dial into Dodgycom ISP and you get allocated an IP address of, 200.20.30.40. Okay, just because it's easy. And what happens is you're 200.20.30.40 and you need to be able to talk to www.dodgycom.com/billing/ slash whatever, because you're trying to figure out why they've overcharged you for the month. Now, what happens when you dial into the access server is that the access server, and we'll keep it Cisco just because we can. Let's say the access server is a 2511 router with 16 serial ports, and connected into 16 of those serial ports are 16 modems, because this is dodgy com and, you know, we're not a very big ISP. When you connect the modems to the access server and you establish a PPP connection from, let's say, for example, the access point is .1, right? Just to keep things simple. So you have 200.20.30.40 and a point-to-point link of 200.20.30.1 is the other end of the PPP connection. So every host, whether you're on .40.41.42.43.44.45, they all have the other end of the PPP connection as 200.20.30.1. Everybody cool with that at the moment? Because that's the access server.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, what has to happen with proxy ARP or gratuitous ARP is that if www.dodgycom.com, which happens to be 200.20.30.97, wants to talk to 200.20.30.40, it needs a MAC address to talk to, because you can only talk to another host on Ethernet via its MAC address. The problem is, however, that for a PPP connection, there is no MAC address.
Okay.
Hurrah! Grace has just made herself $150. Oh,
that was
no.
Quick. Can I do it too?
No, unfortunately, you're in the wrong country. Okay, so what do you think it does? Can anybody guess what it does if 200.20.30.97 needs to talk to 200.20.30.40? What do you think it might do for the MAC address if it needs one? Anybody got any idea?
It will send it to its gateway, which will give it a MAC address and say, okay, talk to me. Something like that.
No.
It'll simulate
no, it won't. No. That's okay. Good guess. But no cigar. What happens is the access server ARPs for all of the MAC addresses for the dial-in clients. So whenever the dial-in clients come in and send packets, the access server, when asked for an ARP request for .40.41.42.43, responds with the IP address for the MAC address for .1 for all of those clients, so that when other hosts on the subnet ask for the MAC address of any of the dial-in clients, they basically get handed the MAC address of the dial-in server, and everything sends its packets back to the dial-in server, and it all works.
And how does it mediate incoming traffic then?
It doesn't. It basically grabs all of the packets destined for its MAC address, and then it opens the packets up and looks at the IP addresses to find out where they're actually destined, which is what a router has to do, because the PPP host is technically a router.
Yeah, okay.
So that's how my dial-up ISP used to work. Interesting.
The only reason I'm intimately familiar with this is because I used to work for a dial-up ISP, and I had to actually configure. And then when I got the girlfriend that wanted internet access through my house, I also needed to actually configure my dial-up modem so that she could dial in on a ringback system and get access to the internet so that she could get on Yahoo Games. The things we do.
These were shell accounts, right? You would dial in and get it? Or was PPP also TCP IP kind of accounts?
It was PPP. It was PPP. No, I was running PPP. I ran a PPP server on my Linux box. And then at the height of my career, so to speak, I had four phone lines. One that connected me to Telstra, one that connected me to my ISP, and then two different dial-in numbers so that you could either come in via voice or via data. And I could actually have people dial in and use my internet, which was all a bit of fun and quite a learning experience.
Okay. So basically what you're saying is that the access server is handing out a single MAC address for whatever app requests that come in. So the packets are routed back to it.
It hands out a single MAC address for all of the dial-in clients it is handling. So it gratuitously ARPs for a particular range of IP addresses.
Okay, that's clear.
Alrighty. Now, one of the other things you can do, and this is probably worth doing, if you have a virtual Linux machine with a bridged interface, or you have, you can do it on one of the bundle boxes, but it's best to do it on a live network, try running TCP dump space ARP on a live network and just watch for a minute or three the ARP requests come in. And then you'll find out, why is this device still talking to 172.91.40.81? I'll just go and fix that. It's kind of cool to see what sort of stuff is still bouncing around the network that really you didn't even know of.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay, so any questions on proxy ARP? I think we've pretty much covered that. We're not going to go into how to implement it, but that's pretty much how it works. Okay, so here's a question for you. What happens if you add a static ARP entry for somebody else's computer to your routing table? And you, while the other machine isn't around.
Do they have some sort of expiry mechanism like TTL on TCP? I don't. They must have.
Yeah, and where are you going?
Because there must be a way of refreshing the cache or clearing the cache or.
Oh, okay, all right. So just finding out where Grace is going. I don't think. Okay, yeah, they have an expiry mechanism, but if you actually poison the ARP table and stick in your IP address for somebody else's MAC address, you can actually steal their traffic, and that's called ARP poisoning.
Yeah, you do it with Kane, which is kind of accessible, and you can. That's the only place where I've seen the JAWS autographic labeler feature work. And you poison the ARP, you get all the traffic, and it slows down the network like hell.
It certainly does. It's certainly not the best way to do it. You know, the other place I've seen the JAWS autographic labeler work just out of morbid curiosity is VMware. It'll actually auto-label the toolbars.
Yeah, I just reinstalled VMware. Ha ha ha.
Okay, well, VMware Workstation, you can actually label the toolbar and then you can actually click on, like, power on, power off and all that sort of stuff if that's something you want to do. But the autographic labeler does pick those up.
I've never tried. I always just did it from the menu, but hey, that'll work.
I think you can actually do like the insert whatever it is thing for toolbars. Does anybody know, and I this was a question that was posed to me this morning, I didn't think it could, can NVDA read the status line in Office?
I don't know, but give me 2 seconds and I'll tell you.
Okay, cool.
You mean with a specific function?
No, just whether you can press insert page down or whatever and it'll read the status line. Because one of the instructors is saying that they couldn't get it to read the status line.
Insert page down does not. It doesn't say anything. And my Braille display says Word document, one Microsoft Word document. What? What the hell is this? $T and then a blinking cursor.
Oh, interesting. We know that in Beta 2, by the way, it doesn't actually read when you move by line, but apparently they're coming up with a fix for that.
Yeah, I saw that. Now let's see if I can interact here quickly and read the status line. Insert page down does not.
Fair enough. We don't need to read that right now. There we go. So when are you going to cave in, Pranav, and get an Apple device? Grin.
Ha ha ha. I'll probably came into Android first.
Yeah. Have fun with that.
If there's a way, it's not sort of obvious from the commands I know off the top of my head. I can't figure it out.
Okay, no worries. We didn't think there was. But this one of the Sri Lankan instructors was asking because they're trying to teach Office with NVDA, which is a challenge. Okay. What other things are we going to cover today? Cable pinouts, they don't ask you about. They will often...
What a relief.
Well, as far as I know, I've never seen them ask you about... there used to be questions in the CCNA where they would say, what is wrong with this cable? And either it would be a miswired pair, or it would be a short or something. Now, what you need to know to answer these questions, and I'll give you the base knowledge that you need to know. 1 and 2 must be a twisted pair. 3 and 6 must be a twisted pair. 4 and 5 must be a twisted pair. And 7 and 8 must be a twisted pair. 1, 2, 3, 6, 4, 5, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3, 6, 4, 5, 7, 8. Don't make me sing.
Okay, that's useful to know.
Now, the fact is that if you're actually making a cable, you will need to know which colours you will need to put on the particular pairs. So whether it's green, white, green, or whatever the hell they want, that depends. That's what denotes T568A and T568B, which colour actually turns up on that pair for those particular standards. And obviously, T568A has a colour at one end for 1 and 2, and it has a different coloured pair at the other end for T568B, which is what gives you your crossover cable.
And what was that MDIX? That's different from this. This is very confusing.
No, no, that's exactly the same. MDI is T568A, and MDIX is T568B.
Oh, okay.
So all the MDI / MDIX button does is crosses over the transmit and receive pairs when you press it so that you can use a straight through cable to link switches together. You don't have to mess with crossover cables.
But these are physical pins, right? So the cables will be soldered over. How do you cross them like that?
It's like a... They do it... Well, they're physical pins, but when they run from the wall jack or the inside of the switch, you've got a circuit that just flips those pins around. Like, it just when you push the switch in, it closes a different set of tracks on the circuit board to actually make the pins appear in a different order.
Oh, okay.
I got it.
I think that's right. Have you come back in? That's how they work, isn't it? Those MDI, MDIX buttons that you press on the switch, it's just like a switch that just puts in a different set of tracks to switch the circuit board around, so that the 1, 2 appear where 3 and 6 were, and 3, 6 appear where 1 and 2 are. Yeah. Well, not the auto ones. You know the manual ones where you used to push the button and it would turn it into a crossover port? Like, you press the button on one switch and it... you don't actually do it in the end of the connector. You actually line the wires up first outside the connector, and then you squish them all together a long ways and slide them into the connector once you've got them in the right order.
Still sounds dicey.
Well, we're nobody's expecting you guys to build the cables. We're just expecting you guys down to Cables R Us and buy them.
Which is why I don't know how to do this manually, because I'm exactly what I do, it's actually cheaper than the time it takes to go by.
Exactly. And you know what? If they sell you a cable that doesn't work, you often take the cable back to them with the receipt, and they give you another cable because they don't care. And they give you another one, and you take it back, and it works. Do you guys have to provide proof of purchase when you guys do warranty returns in Canada, just out of morbid curiosity? Because you do in Australia.
For most things. I mean, it depends on the merchant. Big companies more so. Little computer stores where I buy cables and memory and various things, half the time I don't even have receipts. They just, we all know each other. I go, how much are you going to charge me for this today? But no, generally you do have to provide proof of purchase.
Ah, because Grace bought a 3G dongle from Optus shop, turfed out the receipt, And then the dongle failed, and she went to take it back in and get it replaced. And they're like, no, you have to have the receipt to prove that you got it from us. And she didn't have the receipt, so we had to buy her another dongle, which was very unhappy.
Legally, that is a requirement. Most places, you know, unless it's a big corporation, like, I mean, I've had all kinds of problems with computer things, printers and various things that I didn't have receipts for, and they wouldn't even do it RMA. But small shops that you sort of get to know, you can get away with it. But no, big companies, you have proof of purchase, and that's your warranty, and if you don't have it, you don't get warranty.
Yep, that was my experience. Okay, variants of Ethernet, they don't test that. There's 100 megabit, there's 10 megabit, there's gigabit. It can run on fiber, or it can run on copper. And basically, single-mode fiber goes further than multi-mode fiber is all you need to know for the test. And fiber usually uses an SC, or subscriber connector, and you need two fibers for a full duplex link. So that's about all you need to know on that.
That's good news.
Okay. Modes. Modes is important. They usually have a question on that in the test. Can anybody tell me what the prompt for user exec mode on a router called router would be?
Router greater than.
That's exactly right. Router greater. Okay, so anybody know what the prompt for a router in enabled mode would be?
Hash. Router hash.
That is correct. Think of the super user prompt in Linux.
Yeah, the Americans will probably call it pound.
But I think the hash is actually different to the pound sign, isn't it? I was asking somebody this the other day, because on my iPod there's actually a pound and a hash.
I've seen them used interchangeably, but you might be right.
I thought the pound was British.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, but North America tends to refer to or as router number sign, which I've never actually heard anyone say, but that's how a lot of the screen readers say it is number sign.
I'll just find out. Ian is not here. I can't ask him. Okay. Curious, because I actually do have a pound sign and a number sign on my iPod, so I was just curious about that, because people do sort of ask me, you know, ASAP refers to it as number sign usually. But anyway, it's a number sign. Router hash, router noughts and crosses grid. Apparently it's even referred to as an octothorpe. If you actually look up the pronunciation guide in the jargon file, it's actually also called an octothorpe. But we won't call it that, we promise. All right.
Is that where Bill got his domain name from?
Yeah, probably. Does anybody know what the prompt for a router would be if you are in global configuration mode?
Oh, router config, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's router pound config, or router hash config, or however you want to say it.
No, it's actually router config number. The pound always goes at the end. The hash sign always goes at the end.
Right, okay. Yeah. Now, is it router config one word, or router space config pound?
Router space config pound space. I believe. They won't get that finicky. They won't do spacing. You just got to get them around the right way. Now, if you're going to be in interface configuration mode, it's router config-if pound. Okay, so router config-if is for interface configuration.
Okay.
If you want to revise these, may I recommend that you play games on the remote bundle and see what the prompts show up. I might have to check this one. In router configuration mode, what is it? It helps if we actually tell it that you want telnet instead of SSH. How many times do I do that? Alrighty, enable. Config T. Oh, it's actually chocolate left parenthesis config right parenthesis number. So the actual config is in parentheses. So I was just correcting that because I didn't say that. And if you are in router configuration mode, it's config-router in parentheses. So the router name followed by the mode you are in parentheses followed by the pound sign is basically what you're looking for if you get a question on that.
Okay, it's almost like the hierarchy where, and it's kind of weird, he's putting the middle level at the end of the prompt.
Who is?
See, the first mode is user exec, which is the greater than sign. Then comes the hash with what do you call this, privileged exec mode or whatever.
Okay, and so when you go config. So when you go config, config is a submode of privileged exec, so it goes in parentheses.
It's a submode, okay.
And then when you go into interface configuration mode, config-if, interface configuration mode is a submode of config global config mode. So it's a suffix with a dash and the submode.
Okay, that's useful.
Okie dokie, let's bail out of there. Alright, I'm not home tonight, by the way, Pranav, so you won't be taking it tonight unless you want to do it by yourself, which I wouldn't recommend. But I will be home tomorrow.
Now, tonight's the pre-final that I will try myself, but yeah, the final is something with you.
Okay, have I activated the practice final for you guys? You might want to check that, because I may need to reactivate it. I'll try and check after lecture as well.
I'm actually a bit confused. Maybe I should save this for not on the recording, but you can kill it. I'm actually, when I went to look, because I was looking for a practice final, I'm actually enrolled in this course twice. Two separate instances of the same thing.
Wow. Okay, I better look into that when Ian gets back, because theoretically you shouldn't be able to be in both at once. I mean, admittedly, it'd be a wonderful solution for you having too much work to do is to clone yourself off and then, like, just allocate your clone some tasks that need doing. And that way you can, you know, put young kid to bed and do Cisco at the same time. It'd be great. But I'll honestly find out what's going on the system and find out why that's happening.
I mean, how on earth do you read the grade book? Because I saw all that flash and I saw the stuff after it. Because all I was trying to do was figure out, have I taken chapter 11 or not?
I think it's blank. If you, like, in the row, the table row that's a score, it's nothing if you haven't taken it.
Oh, okay. Hmm.
Yeah, basically it has, like, skills test, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10, chapter 11, practice final, skills, lab mark. And then that's the table. And then all of the numbers are below it. And if you use the JAWS table commands, they actually work on the grade book, surprisingly. And it will actually tell you what chapter the mark refers to. I was surprised.
Okay, interesting. I always forget what the JAWS table commands are anyway.
Control
Sorry, it's
the
a column piece. With the specific grade, because the grades go across a row. So it'll be an empty column if you haven't.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So okay. all you have to know with the JAWS table commands is Control-Alt left and right move you along from column to column, and then Control-Alt up and down move you up and down by rows. There are other commands, but I never use them.
Okay, good enough.
And the same commands work in NVDA if you happen to be in that screen reader as well, which is kind of handy. Alrighty, now, I think the only other pending thing we've got, unless anybody has any questions... Okay, I was going to cover one thing before we get on to subnetting. Layers of the OSI reference model as a pair to layers of the TCP/IP model. Okay? Shall we do a quick run-through of what maps to what, just so that we're all clear and decide what all this stuff is?
Yeah. Still gives me a bit of a nightmare.
Alright. TCP/IP layer has four layers. Network access, internet, transport, and application. We're happy with that?
I am.
Yeah.
Okay, I can sense the unhappiness building, but let's say we're happy with this for the moment before we, you know, before our day takes a downward spiral, all right? Network access is layers 1 and 2 of the OSI reference model. Physical and data link. How do we get the frames onto the wire, the fiber, the copper, the cable, the air? Network access is layers 1 and 2 of the OSI reference model.
Okay.
Okay, so we're still happy with
that so far.
Right, we're not breaking out the chocolate bars yet because it hasn't really got that sad. We are now happy with that layer. Now, internet layer maps to network layer of the OSI reference model. One-to-one mapping, easy peasy.
Okay, that's nice. TCP, IP, and IP addresses and stuff.
Yes, IP addresses and routing and stuff all happen in the internet / network layer of the OSI reference model.
Okay.
Now, transport maps to transport. That's handy too.
Surprise!
However, application maps to session, presentation, and application in the OSI reference model. So the top three layers get bundled in to the application layer of the TCP/IP model.
No harm done, I suppose. It's okay.
And that's that. Now, as far as what things happen at what levels, we're going to go through that now. The physical stuff is layer 1. We're all happy about that. Bits, voltages, all that sort of stuff. Data link deals with frames and access to the media. Now that splits into two layers. It's got the media access control. In other words, are we using KSMACT or are we using CSMACD or are we using round robin or what are we doing to get the stuff on there? Followed by the logical link control, which is where you have things like your frame size and your frame check sequences and all that sort of stuff. So that all happens at layer 2 of the OSI reference model.
Yeah, all good.
Layer 3 is the network layer. We deal with our IP addresses and we deal with our routing at that layer.
So our ARP is actually a layer 2 thing, right?
Yes, it most definitely is. ARP is the bridge between layers 2 and 3. Of the OSI reference model as far as TCP is concerned. ARP bridges you from layer 2 to 3.
That's a nice way to think about it.
Well, I thought so. That's why I said it. Look, the only reason I'm so familiar with this stuff, and I use the word familiar because I'm going to trip over something in a minute now that I've said that, is because I started with this stuff in 1995. That's the only reason why I remember it all, because I've been over it so many times. But yeah, ARP is the bridge between layers 2 and 3 of the OSI reference model.
Okay, fair enough.
Now, the transport layer deals with getting a reliable stream of packets from one end to the other. So, what protocol do you think would operate at the transport layer in the OSI reference model? Which protocol do you think would operate there?
TCP.
It certainly does. And it is actually your sequence numbers that are relevant at the transport layer.
PDU is segments, right, at the transport layer, once the ports are assigned?
No, the ports actually live up in the session layer.
Okay, session, no, are you sure?
I'm 90% sure. And I'm just going to get Google to make me 100%
sure. That they would be, because the ports are sort of limited duration things that live only for that particular session, and then they go away. And it, I mean, it uses a sort of predefined set of them, but I think they come up and go down each time a session happens between two hosts. That was a terrible explanation, but I know what I meant.
I know what you meant, but I have a feeling ports were in transport.
No, I don't think they are, because the ports are specific to a specific session. A session is defined by a socket pair, and that needs to be a source IP and a source port and a destination IP and a destination port.
Okay, fine by me.
Okay, what am I looking for here? Okay, so it talks about this in the TCP/IP book, and they sort of reference that there. But essentially, I would think that the port numbers actually exist in the session layer, because that defines which session you're talking about. The Telnet session to the remote bundle, the SSH session to whatever, the web session to Facebook. Although I think it is a sort of a matter for debate, because I did say that the session presentation and application layers were all lumped together at the top as far as the application was concerned, so I don't think it's a clear-cut division. Oh, okay, Wikipedia agrees with Pranav. In computer networking, the transport layer provides end-to-end source and destination port numbers.
Yeah, that's what I saw on the notes. I was quite sure.
Oh, okay. That seems strange, but anyway.
Yeah, look, it's all... the reason they say this is because TCP supports virtual circuits, but UDP doesn't, and you can still have port numbers in UDP. So may I refer everybody to the... transport layer article in Wikipedia to have a read through that.
Okay.
Now, UDP packets are called datagrams instead of segments, because unless you are using TCP, you don't actually have any segments, because the datagrams are not sequenced and there is no reliable delivery. So I just thought I'd point that out.
Can you repeat that?
I said that UDP, the packets in UDP are referred to as datagrams, not segments, because there is no sequencing or ordering in UDP.
Yeah, okay, that's right. I mean, it's, you know, sending stuff out and hope it gets there and in some reasonable stream. There's no, I don't think there's any error correction mechanism either, is there?
Not at that level. If an application wants an error detection correction mechanism over a UDP stream, such as NFS or similar, it has to be provided by the application at the application layer. Okie dokie. So that is that. So I'd look at the transport layer article, because I certainly will look at it a little bit later on this morning. But luckily, the questions they ask you tend to hinge around the network layer and the data link layer and stuff, so it's not usually at that sort of grey area that they tend to ask you questions. Alrighty, now, what sort of subnetty things did we need to go over, do you think? Because we've sort of flogged subnetting to death, but if we need to flog it some more, I'm happy to do that. I'm just not sure which bits we need to concentrate on.
I think okay. It's more now a matter of paying attention than sort of learning the mechanism to do it. You know, being sure I count the ones and zeros properly. But I think I basically have been through the mechanics enough times that I have it.
It's not so much the mechanics. I think in my case, it's more about question types, that if you get this kind of a question, this is what you're supposed to do. That's about it.
Okay, so... if you say had a question that said... on a network of... on a network 172.16. 21.0/16, how many 4,096 address subnets can be created from such a network? Sort of questions that hit you like that.
Yes, precisely. I mean, it's just about tackling something like this. Where do you start? What do you do?
All right. So if you wanted to know how many 4,096 address subnets you could create from a 172.16.0/16 network. Okay. So how many bits in a /16 do you have for the network portion?
16 bits. Ah,
Yeah, that's
wait,
right.
How many
yeah.
bits? Yeah, 16, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 16.
Yeah. And how many do you have for the host?
16.
All right, so you've got 16 and 16 for the host at the moment. Now, if you have a 4,095 address subnet or whatever, how many... If you have... How many hosts could you possibly have for 16 bits of host? What would be the roughly the maximum number of hosts you could have?
2 to the power of 16 minus 2?
Yeah, which is 65,534. Okay, so that's the maximum number of hosts you could have on the whole subnet. The way you would find out how many 4,096 address subnets would be you would divide 65,536, which is the size of the entire address space, by 4,096. And I've got a calculator here, so I'll just do that. You could have 16 of those subnets.
Oh, okay.
Now, what's another way of doing that? Because I've just thought of another way of doing it, for another way you could slice dice and look at it. If you look at how big a 4,096 address subnet has to be, it has to have at least 12 bits to be able to represent 4,096.
Okay, how do you figure that out?
Well, if you've got 8 bits, you've got 256. Oh, sorry, it's going to work through. So if you've got 8 bits, you've got 256. If you've got 9 bits, you've got 512. You've got 10 bits, you've got 1,024. 11 bits, 2,048. 12 bits, 4,096. That's how I would have done it.
Oh, okay,
Yeah, Brian's right.
Now, admittedly, I'm almost... I mean, with some of this stuff, I'm getting to the point where I cheat and I've memorized... specific masks and stuff, but I don't think, I suspect everyone does that who does any degree of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, I do it all the time. I mean, I just sort of remember the patterns and look at the patterns and how they fall. But okay, if we say we've got 12 bits in this thing that does 4,096 addresses, and we've got 16 bits to play with, it's got 12 bits for the hosts, and we've got 16 bits to use up, does it stand to reason that we've got 4 bits left to play with?
Absolutely.
And 2 to the power of 4 would be 16, which would mean we'd be able to make 16 subnets.
Yay!
So what you've got
cool.
to remember...
I didn't think of it that way.
Yeah, well, see, there we go. So what you're looking at, guys, is you've got three types of bits, and I've been saying this ever since day one, but I'll say it again at day whatever we are at now, just because it might actually make more sense. You have network bits, subnet bits... and host bits. And the fact is that all of those have got to add up to 32. You can rob Peter to pay Paul or rob Paul to pay Peter, but the fact is you've got network bits, you've got subnetting bits, and you've got host bits. The number of subnetting bits you have governs how many subnets you can create. If you've got one subnetting bit, you've got two subnets. If you've got two subnetting bits, you've got four subnets. If you've got three subnetting bits, you've got eight networks. 2 to the power of X equals the number of subnets, where X is the number of bits.
Yeah, now that is handy. And I think we have... This looks familiar, so yeah.
But it stands to reason that now that you've actually been this far through the course, it'll make more sense than when I first said it, which is why I'm saying it again. So you've got network bits, you've got subnet bits, and you've got host bits. You need enough subnet bits to create the number of subnets you need, and you need enough host bits to have a certain number of machines on the subnetting, on the actual subnet. And that's the whole point of subnetting. That's what it all boils down to.
Okay.
So you look at your requirements and you find how many machines do you need on each subnet. Make sure the networks are big enough. Figure out whether you're going to, how many of the subnetting bits you're going to have. The thing you've got to keep in mind is that with variable length subnet masks, which is what we're playing with, VLSM, you've got to have on a network, if you're splitting everything into 32 address subnets, and you have 60 machines on those 32 address subnets, you have to have the two 32 address subnets contiguous so that they can actually have one bigger block, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, in terms of the address lineup is what you're saying. You don't want to separate those.
Yeah, like say for example you've got 192.168.1 and you're subnetting it, and you're subnetting it into 32 address subnets, okay? If you have the first subnet, well, where would the first subnet range from if you had 32 address subnets? Can anybody tell me? You can include the network and broadcast.
0 to 31.
All right. What would the second one be, Pranav?
32 to 64. Or 63, rather.
63.
32 to 63.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, and where would the next one go from, Brian?
64 to 96.
95, but
no,
yep,
95,
I'll give that to you.
Yeah.
It always goes to one less than the power of two above it. So it's got to go from 32 to 63, 64 to 95. It doesn't actually encompass the network address of the next subnet. Okay, guys, so it stands to reason if the first subnet goes from 0 to 31, and the second subnet goes from 32 to 63, and the third one goes from 64 to 96, if we have 64 hosts, or 60 hosts if you like, and we put the first half from 0 to 31, and then we put the second half from 64 to 95, we'd need two routes in the router, wouldn't we? We'd need one for the 30 from the 0 subnet and one for the 64 subnet.
Absolutely.
But if we
but even
run
if they're continue. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
You're maybe going to
I'll let you ask the question because I might be able to answer your question. You're saying even if they're contiguous, what?
You'll still have to do two routes because they're still separate subnets.
No, you won't. If they are connected to the same network segment, all the network mask says is this is how many bits I've got for network and this is how many bits I've got for host. So rather than doing a route for 255.255.255.224, which is your 32 address subnet, on the router you do a route for 255.255.255.192. And that is a 64 address subnet.
Okay, so the crude way I sort of figure this out is if I say it's 192.168.1.1, so as long as 192.168.1, that's one remains constant, I can stick to a single route. The moment I go 192.168.2.1, I switch to a second route. Is that one way of doing it?
That is if you're subnetting on byte boundaries, but as it turns out, we're actually doing it on bit boundaries. But yeah, like if you have a 192.168.1 network and a 192.168.2 network and they're class Cs, you can actually put in a route that would point to those different networks. But see, Okay, say for example you have a class C network and you have 192.168.2.something, just to make it easy, right? And you have 245 machines on your class C network, and somebody puts another 40 machines on. Can you see that that would be a problem, because they all can't fit on the class C?
Yes, because it'll go up only to 256.
So what you do in that case is you set your subnet mask to 255.255.254.0, give it an extra bit, and you actually have a 512 address subnet.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Now, the point I'm trying to make about these, you know, 0, 32, 64, just to go back to my original example, is if you set the addresses to fall correctly, in other words, the largest power of 2 for the biggest size of the network, if you're going to have a 64-size subnet, started at 0, 64, 128, 224, you can then, what you've got to understand about the subnet mask is it only affects the machine it is set on. If I was in a classroom, I would be pounding the desk with a meter ruler when I say this. The subnet mask only affects the machine it is set on. So the router can have different subnet masks to every other machine on your network, provided you as the network technician know what you're doing.
Okay, I mean, that's obvious, but yeah, I never thought about it that way.
Yeah, no, I did, but pounding the ruler is good.
Well, it's one of those things that it took me quite a while to come to terms with. When a router sees a destination address in its, I'm routing this packet to this particular destination address, it ANDs the destination address with the net mask. It then checks it against its network prefixes. If a network prefix matches, it shovels it out that interface. If it doesn't, the packet goes to the default route. That is how a router works.
So how is all of this going to be asked in the test? I don't think we're going to get case studies like the labs, are we?
You kind of do. Like it sort of says, you have a network of this many machines and you are given this subnet. What will be the third subnet in this network? That might be one of the questions.
Okay.
How many questions are on it?
I think it's 50. But some of them are really easy and some of them aren't so easy.
And is it the standard 2-hour window?
3. You get 3 hours. It took me 34 minutes to do the final. So it is somewhat involved. So I would be putting at least an hour aside for it. At least. All right. So, has anyone done the practice final?
No, neither one of us, I don't think, because we were talking about this before you came in, just briefly.
Okay. Well, I'll put the practice final up, and you guys can have a look. You'll often find that the practice final is as difficult, if not slightly harder, than the actual final.
Well, that's good news.
Are there diagram descriptions for the practice in the usual place?
I believe there should be. I'm just about to go and check, but I'm pretty sure I shoveled them up there. And I will make sure that they are in place before the test goes up.
They are up, I think.
I will likely do it.
They are up.
Probably tomorrow.
That's in what? How many hours? I'm just trying to work that out. So are you going to do it in the morning, Brian?
I don't know. It depends how crazy, like, what work kind of work develops. But this is not the real one. This is the practice one, so I don't need Carrie to do it.
That's right. The practice one you guys get to do by yourselves. I don't have to supervise it. I mean, technically, I don't have to supervise the final. But if something goes wrong and I'm not around to fix it, you guys will not be happy. Quite rightly so.
It's worth scheduling a time.
That was my opinion. We actually had one of our students that sort of said, why do we have to be supervised? And I said to this particular student, I said, you don't have to be supervised at all, but when it all goes bad and your exam activation fails, don't come back to us. Because we can't do anything. Alrighty. Unless there's any other pending questions, that's probably about it for the revision lecture as it stands at the moment.
So this ends July 31, the same as the other class?
I think it technically currently ends July 13, but I can go and have a look and see what I can extend it to.
Last time you said 13 was the max, but check, because I'm going to wrap it up next week, whatever, as long as your schedule matches. I've studied enough, I think.
Yeah, I think so. You can overstudy these things, and then you tie yourself in knots, and that's no good. You get to the point where you were really good at it, and then as you continue to study, you actually get diminishing returns, and we don't really want to see that.
No, if it's 13, it's 13. We'll deal.
Put it this way, then, I'm starting one in the last week of July, so I'd want to finish it up. I might be able to drag an extra week out, but I wouldn't want to go much beyond that because I don't want two exploration classes running at once, if I can help it.
We'll make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Agreed.
Stop.
For our own sakes.